Good morning, everyone. We're reading in Book 2, Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life. We've reached page 139, and we stopped at the end of the first sentence on that page, line 249. This canto is called The Kingdoms of the Little Life. Aswapati is seeing, beginning to explore the realms where life first emerges from matter. And we read the first introductory sections where Shobindo gave us the picture of life, the wonderful life goddess who has joyfully poured all her beauty and her bliss on earth and been swallowed up by a dark, ambiguous presence. And now she's as if imprisoned in matter. And on page 135, just before the break, he gives us this poignant picture of her as a lost child, ascending slowly with unconscious steps, a foundling of the gods. She wanders here like a child's soul left near the gates of hell, fumbling through fog in search of paradise. So Aswapati realizes that he will have to find out the whole journey of life from this faint and dim subconscious start, from where it starts from. And we will see him doing that later on. But now what he sees is this tiny, lost child, hardly able to live in the grip of matter. So the creatures, the beings that belong to this stage of evolution, they're such tiny little beings, and there's so little consciousness and so little delight, no delight at all, almost only suffering. There seems to be full of meaningless suffering and grey unease. It hardly seems worth the while to go on living. But then Sri Aurobindo tells us that Aswapati doesn't see it like this. His eyes are able to see the purpose in the works of time, to see that even in that strange, aimless, apparently useless realm, that it is pregnant with magic will and change divine. And that what he's seeing now is, he describes it as the first writhings of the cosmic serpent force, just waking up, uncoiling, raising its head in the warm air of life. It's still cold and rigid, no? It can't yet express itself fully. And so Aswapati tracks all these primitive forms of life to their origin, and he realizes that it's all emerging as if from a spring out of the ground, a miraculous fount, a source. And that source is a mystic presence. Now I'm reading at the bottom of page 138. A mystic presence. None can probe nor rule. Creator of this game of ray and shade. In this sweet and bitter, paradoxical life, asks from the body the soul's intimacies, and by the swift vibration of a nerve, links its mechanic throbs to light and love. It summons the spirit's sleeping memories up from subconscious depths, beneath time's foam, all the bubbles on the surface of time. As the spirit's memories come up They're oblivious. They've forgotten their flame of happy truth. And they arrive on the surface with heavy eyes that hardly see, like me sometimes in the morning. The eyes don't want to open at all. The spirit's memories come disguised as feelings and desires. Like weeds upon the surface, they float a while and they rise and they sink on a somnambulist tide of movement in sleep. That's where we stopped last time. Tuan, would you start today, please? Page 139, line 250. It's the end of the first sentence. Thank you. And this is such a wonderful message from Sri Aurobindo. Impure and degraded, though the motions of life often seem to us. Nevertheless, there's always a heaven truth brooding in life's deeps. We've explained this word brood so many times, somebody should be able to tell me what it means. The images of a mother bird, a hen or a mother bird, sitting on her eggs. She seems to be in a kind of trance, but she's focusing on the eggs, on getting them ready to hatch. So it's like that. In the depths of life, that heaven truth is brooding, focusing on what has to come out, what has to develop. So even in the obscurest members, the obscurest parts of life, that fire, that heaven truth is burning. Because of that, because there's that touch of God's rapture in creation's act, the delight which the Creator felt as He brought forth His creation and which He still enjoys in His creatures, a touch of that, a lost remembrance of felicity, of bliss, is still lurking, hiding in the dumb roots of death and birth in this mortal world where we pass from cradle to grave. The world's senseless beauty, the unconscious beauty, perhaps even apparently meaningless beauty, is reflecting, mirroring God's delight. And the smile of that rapture is secretly everywhere. It's flowing in the wind's breath, in the sap of the trees and plants. It's colorful, hued magnificence, blooms in leaves and flowers. The world's apparently senseless and unconscious beauty is a mirror of God's delight in creating His creation. Alice, would you read? Alice?
When life broke through its half-drowse in the plant that feels and suffers but cannot move or cry, in beast and in winged bird and thinking man, it made of the heart's rhythm its music's beat. It forced the unconscious tissues to awake and ask for happiness and earn its sharp, self-seeing teeth tears our consciousness, our pain and pleasure, have let stand for cause, instinct with it, but blind to its true joy. The soul's desire leaps out towards passing things.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about this passage? Yeah, through the whole passage, it's telling about life. So where it says it, wherever it says it, it is the emerging life, breaking through. It's half drowse in the plant and emerging into animal life. No? When life broke through its half drowse in the plant, there is conscious life in every plant, and actually they do amazing things, no, with their life force. And the plants feel and suffer. They can't speak to us in voices that we can understand. No? But in the animal creation, in beast, in winged bird, and in us human beings, us thinking men, life made of the heart's rhythm, its music's beat, the beating of our hearts. It's the sign that there's life in the body. If that stops, then something is seriously wrong. It's life that forced the unconscious tissues to wake up and to ask for happiness. And what they get in return is pain, of course. But still, the tissues can thrill with pleasure. They can laugh with brief delight sometimes. And they are conscious enough to quiver with pain and to crave for ecstasy. Our very senses cry for bliss, says Sri Aurobindo. Life is imperative, voiceless, ill understood. Here in the material world, it's too far from light, but it's still so close to the very core, the heart of being. It's born strangely in time from the eternal bliss. That's its source, no? We read that right at the beginning of Canto 3. Life is pressing on our heart's core, the very center of our being, and on our nerves, our vibrant nerves. And it's trying to find its true self, fumbling through fog in search of paradise, we read, no? So its sharp self-seeking tears our consciousness. That's why we feel pain and suffering. Our pain and pleasure have that sting for cause, the need of life for bliss. Our whole being is instinct with that force, but we are blind to its true joy, its true source, its true meaning. But the desire of our soul still leaps out towards passing things without understanding what it is that we really want. We're on page 139 at the bottom of the page. Yes?
There is a craving for delight. It's just in us.
Yes.
It's innate in us, but we can't reach that pure state. So in spite of that, we go for an alternative or a compromise. Delight and pressure and all these things, which is justified?
Yes, of course it's justified. It's life in us seeking for its true fulfillment, and that it's meant to receive that true fulfillment. But for that, evolution has to go on quite a lot longer in us. No? But it's somehow very helpful to us to know. It's many, many years ago now, I don't know how many decades, but I first heard some pundit explaining that we are all the time longing for the Ananda, the divine Ananda. And whatever we want, actually what we really want is that. So whatever else we want, we may or may not get it. But in any case, we can't be satisfied. We will always go on wanting more and more and more things. And if we know that it's not just things that we want, and it's not just passing satisfactions that we want, it's that fulfillment of the divine life in matter. That's what we want. That will help us. We will begin to become more conscious of why we are here and what we really want. That's the meaning of our lives, of our individual lives, to develop more and more and more and make that true Ananda more possible here on earth.
Your question is, when you compromise, instead of saying that I only want that, you don't say that. The goal seems to be diverted and wandered off from the real want. Is it, are you understanding my point?
Yeah, what do you do about it?
I don't know.
Well, notice, what do you do about it? I mean, usually we're very happy to take passing satisfactions.
Yes.
We're very grateful for a little comfort and a little enjoyment.
Should we sacrifice that for the higher one?
If we know how to do that. But I think a more effective way is to offer it, to say, this bliss doesn't belong to me. This is not for me, little me. This is for the divine purpose in humanity, no? And the less self-centered I can be about it, the more useful it's going to be. In at the beginning of the Isha Upanishad, it says, all this is a habitation for the Lord. The Lord is living in it. Everything that moves in this moving universe, it belongs to him. By that renounced, thou shouldst enjoy. Lust not after any man's possession. We're supposed to enjoy it, but we can only enjoy it when we truly, when we know that it doesn't belong to us. We offer our enjoyment to the Lord. And we don't crave for anything that anybody else has, anything of any kind. Lust not after any man's possession. He says, if it's like that in you, then you should wish to live 100 years enjoying for the Lord.
The example that I find in this passage, in this whole section, relates to hormones in the physical body.
Yes.
And they are very, very powerful, and even by some described as God. They are God in the chemistry of the body.
Yes.
And so one example of a time where most humans experience, most female humans experience the most divine love is at the time of birth, when their body is flooded with the hormone oxytocin. And that hormone powers not only the mother, but the infant. And that is some of the most selfless love that I've ever seen and ever experienced. And so I would say not so much that we reject or go away from them, but that we recognize and know and enlighten ourselves about what's really happening in our body. And we can know so much now.
Yes, and it's not only the physical processes, the experiences that we have. I also remember a moment like that with a baby, What love came to me from that baby. That's the purest, most powerful love I've ever experienced in my life, I think. No? So that's the true love. That's what we really want. No? So if we want to live that, we have a lot of purification to do. It's worth doing. And we're not doing it only for ourselves as individuals. We're doing it for the evolution of the whole human race and for the evolution of the world. No, that's the fulfillment that everything is supposed to move towards. And I think he evokes it so so beautifully in these lines, no? So read the next lines. Who's next? Lorraine, would you read? It's line 276. Thank you. So all of us have experienced nature's longing drive that none of us can resist. There's no thing about resisting it, no? It comes, can't help it. It comes surging through the blood and quickened sense. And of course, spiritual seekers through the ages have felt that they had to resist that. There's something impure and degraded about that, and that they have to eradicate it in themselves. Sri Aurobindo's telling us something completely different. No? He's telling us that this feeling, this nature's longing drive, the cause of it is an ecstasy of the infinite. But in us limited, half-developed human beings, it turns in us to finite loves and lusts, the will to conquer and have, ambition of all kind, to seize and keep all kinds of egoism, no? To enlarge life's room and scope and pleasure's range. It's such a strong impulse in us human beings to battle and overcome and make one's own. The hope to mix one's joy with others' joy. That's also a very, very strong drive, no? A yearning to possess and be possessed, to enjoy and be enjoyed, to feel, to live. Here, at the very beginnings of the emergence of life in matter, here was its early, brief attempt to be. Its rapid end of momentary delight, whose stamp of failure haunts all ignorant life. We can't achieve that longing drive which nature is driving us to. Stamp of failure and dissatisfaction. It's haunting us as long as we are ignorant. That's why Sri Aurobindo is sharing that knowledge with us to help us with that. And now he puts it again so poignantly. Mina, will you read? No, you don't want to read? Paula, 289. Inflicting still.
Inflicting still its habits on selves, the phantom of a dark and evil start, ghost pursues all that we dream and do. Although on earth our firm established lives, a working of habit or a sense of law, a steady repetition in the flux, yet are its roots of will ever the same. These passions are the stuff of which we are made. This was the first cry of the awaking world. It clings around us still and clamps the guard. Even when reason is born and soul takes form in beast and reptile and in thinking man, it lasts and is the fount of all their life. This too was needed, that breath and living might be.
Thank you. Yes.
So I'm wondering about where the bliss or the...
Sorry?
I'm wondering about this ananda, this bliss or this longing for satisfaction.
Yes.
To what extent is it on our own hands, because there's all this experience or stories of people reaching satisfaction or bliss or ananda without wanting.
Yes, there's a sudden blessing of gift, no? Yes. But most of us, we feel this other thing, no? The dissatisfaction, the inability to achieve. It can come perhaps like a wonderful grace. Yeah. And what he's telling us is that somehow from matter, from this very emergence of life in matter, that's like this dark and evil start. It's like a ghost, it's pursuing us all the time, this contradiction between the limitation and unconsciousness and darkness of matter and the emerging delight of life, which finds itself constantly hampered and blocked. And that's a habit in our cells. So it pursues like a ghost everything that we dream and do. And even that applies even at this stage where lives are no longer just coming and going as in this stage he's describing. There's firm established lives, there's a working of habit, even a sense of law that things have to be like that. There's a steady repetition. The roots of will from which these things emerge are still the same. These passions are the stuff. It's the body. It's the stuff of which we are made. And that means that we are still carrying in us this first cry of the awaking world that's clinging around us, and it's clamping the God that is within us potentially. So even when reason is born, even when the soul develops in animals, in reptiles, and in thinking man, that defect is there and is at the fountain of all our life force. And then he says, this too was needed. It looks like a mistake. It looks very regrettable. But he says, this too was need, that breath and living might be. It's something necessary.
In line 290, what is the dark and evil start?
It's described at the end of Canto 3. It's when life, the life goddess, in response to the aspiration that's somehow emerging from matter, she left the heard the call and left her native light, that paradisal life world, which is her true origin, her eternal home, and overflows from her bright, magnificent plane onto the rigid coil and sprawl of mortal space. I'm reading at the top of page 130. That gracious, great-winged angel poured out all her splendor and her swiftness and her bliss, hoping to fill a fair new world with joy. She cast the immortal's fire into matter. And everything, she smote matter with her charm and beauty and forced delight on earth's insensible frame. So our earth woke up to life. It becomes alive, clothed with trees and herbs and flowers. There is a wonderful explosion of delight. Earth's great brown body smiled towards the skies. Azure replied to azure in the sea's laugh. New sentient creatures filled the unseen deeps of the sea, perhaps, no? Life's glory and swiftness ran in the beauty of beasts. Man dared and thought and met with his soul the world. But while the magic breath was on its way, before her gifts could reach our prisoned hearts, a dark, ambiguous presence questioned all. The secret will that robes itself with night and offers to spirit the ordeal of the flesh, imposed a mystic mask of death and pain, interned now in the slow and suffering years sojourns the winged and wonderful wayfarer. She's imprisoned in this material world. She can no more recall her happier state. She has to obey the law of the inconscience. The inconscience which is the foundation of this world in which blind limits are on beauty laid, and sorrow and joy as struggling comrades live. All the contradictions and dualities of our world. A dim and dreadful muteness fell on her. Abolished was her subtle, mighty spirit, and slain her boon of child-god happiness, and all her glory into littleness turned, and all her sweetness into a maimed desire. To feed death with her works is here life's doom. So veiled was her immortality that she seemed inflicting consciousness on unconscious things, an episode in an eternal death, a myth of being that must forever cease. Such was the evil mystery of her change. That's that dark and evil start.
So is the dark and evil start the fact that it's only momentary delight? Every time it tries to reach the delight, it flops and has to start over.
I think at the quite near the beginning of The Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo explains how in this emergence from the unconsciousness, the first thing that happens is the organization of matter. And out of organized matter, or into organized matter in the way it's told here, is infused the principle of life. But the principles of life are contradicted by the principles of matter. Matter is solid, dense, inert, unconscious, or at least it doesn't have any means of expressing consciousness. But the consciousness is there, the consciousness has to emerge. And the first emergence is in the form of these struggling life forms. And we are still carrying all that in our bodies, in ourselves. So it's affecting our waking consciousness. Although now he will tell us about the development of animals and the development of mind. Here we are, our fixed lives, established lives, reasoning power and all that. But the roots are still the same. So what comes up into our individual expression, it's carrying with it this anguish of the imprisonment of matter in the inner, the imprisonment of life, the free life spirit made for delight in all these blind limits of matter. But the interesting thing is, on this page 130, this has all happened because of this dark, ambiguous presence. No? Line 517. This dark, ambiguous presence is actually the expression of a secret will that disguises itself as night and darkness and unconsciousness. It does that to offer to spirit, to the highest consciousness. It offers to spirit the ordeal, the painful test of having a material body, a living material body. And that's what has brought about this mask of death and pain, and there's a reason behind it, which we could read this morning if we go back to where we were. We were at the top of page 140, no? Or a bit further. Right, let's read on from there. We will read something amazing. It's line 302, 303. Who's reading? Tomoko. Oh, is it Doris there? Would you read, Doris? Thank you. Let's have a look at this first. This is the challenge that is given to spirit in the material world, in the emergence of consciousness. No? What is happening is that the spirit inhabits this finite, limited world where there is no true knowledge. And its task is to rescue that imprisoned consciousness. And first of all, the consciousness gets forced out, little jets, like little jets of water or gas coming out at one point or another point, out of the inconscience sealed infinitude. A little jet here, a little jet there, a little jet there. These are brief lives. And then slowly it gathers mass. It looks up at light. That's what's beginning to happen to us. We're beginning, these fixed lives have been established. We're beginning to look up at light. And this earth nature lives tied to her origin, to the earth, to the material principle. So this nether force, this lower force, which is her origin, is still holding on to her, clutching her tight. Out of unconscious depths, her instincts leap, all our instincts. Her life is a neighbor, it's very close to insentient naught, the nothingness of total unconsciousness. Under this law, this is how this ignorant world has been made. But why? Who's the next person to read? Tomoko.
Mystic invoking
aeonic. It's from eons, actually. Aeonic game. Aeonic, I think. Thank you. This is such a wonderful expression of the great mystery. Sri Aurobindo seems to refer to a time that's, or a state that's referred to in Sanskrit as asat, non-being, non-existence, which is a mystery. How can there be? It's an enigma. In the enigma, the mystery, the puzzle of the dark and vast, in the passion and self-loss of the infinite, as if infinite being can lose itself, no? When all was plunged in the negating void, into the emptiness, the nothingness. How and why could it happen? Elsewhere in the poem he will tell us, but for now he just says there was such a state. And how could that state be saved? That night of non-being could never have been saved if being had not plunged into the dark, carrying with it its triple mystic cross. The mother has explained the cross as the connection between the creator and the creation, which is resisted, denied. And in the drawing which she's made of this triple mystic cross, it's not only denied once, it's denied three times. And this triple mystic cross, well, its work is to invoke in world time, in the creation, in the manifestation, the timeless truth, the truth that rules beyond the manifestation, to bring that truth into this world. How does it work? By a tremendous sacrifice. Bliss changed to sorrow. Knowledge made ignorance. God's force turned into a child's helplessness can bring down heaven by their sacrifice. Sat, being, chit, tapas, God's force, and ananda, bliss changed to sorrow. Knowledge made ignorant. God's force turned into a child's helplessness. This sacrifice can bring down heaven into the world of non-being. A contradiction is the foundation, the base of life. The eternal, the divine reality has faced itself with its own contraries. It's done it deliberately. Being has turned into non-being. Knowledge has turned into ignorance. Force into helplessness. Bliss into sorrow. Being became the void, and conscious force became nescience and the walk, the movement of a blind energy. And ecstasy, bliss, took on the figure of world pain. And he says that this is part of a plan in a mysterious dispensation's law, a dispensation, the arrangements that the divine makes. A wisdom, there is a supreme wisdom that is caring for the creation and is preparing its far off ends, its distant intentions. This is how she has planned to start her game, her slow, aeonic game. So because of that, we live in the world that we live in. Venkat, you would like to read?
Love and hate and fear and hope continues in the nursery of mind. higher place, then can they see and speak and dust to dust. In a larger consciousness, they appear like the two embrace and strive and each knowledge. Regarding closer of the pyramid's face, even in this formless violence, he could feel. Matter's response to an infant still of soul, in nature he saw the mighty spirit concealed. Watch the weak birth of a tremendous force, pursue the rhythm of Godhead's tentative face. Hear the faint rhythms of a great unborn use.
Thank you. This is the game that goes on in the world across the eons. It's a blindfold search and wrestle, blind man's buff, a fumbling clasp. And there's these twins, nature and soul, a half-seen nature and a hidden soul. They play blind man's buff and they play hide and seek in twilight rooms. Earlier, Shobindo had described these twilight rooms of the nursery. That's the world, the game that we know, that we're engaged in, a play of love and hate and fear and hope. This is going on in the nursery of mind. It's a hard and heavy romp. Romp is energetic play, which often leads to tears. It's the struggle to find each other, find themselves, of these self-born twins, nature and soul.
Can you say something of self-born twins?
What would you like me to say? These are the twins, nature and
twins?
Nature and soul.
And self-born are both.
It means they have given birth to themselves. They are born, of course, from the One. Or they are, together they are the One. So through the whole play of evolution, this is what goes on. But in the end, at last, the struggling energy that's within nature, which is driving nature, can emerge from its bondage, we could say, and it can meet soul, the voiceless being, in wider fields, not these restricted fields of ignorance. Nature and soul will see each other, communicate, embrace in that larger consciousness, in that clearer light. Two will embrace. For a while they will strive, and then they will recognize. Each of them will recognize the other when they look closely into their playmate's face.
The dark ambiguous presence that was we've been referring to here. And then later, as the story unfolds and we actually have a personification of this, would you say that's a correct parallel, that this is a parallel to death further on?
Oh yes, definitely. It's what becomes death, yes. And it's expressed earlier on. If we have a little time, we can look here. Page 17. This is when Shobindo is describing Savitri's mission. He describes how she's brought her blissful being from the highest levels, incarnated on earth, but here that bliss cannot survive. There's a darkness in terrestrial things that will not suffer long. It won't allow too glad a note. So this inescapable hand closes on Savitri too. One dealt with her who meets the burdened great. That one is the assigner of the ordeal and the path. Each of us is given our challenge and our path. This assigner chooses in the holocaust of the soul, when the soul makes this great sacrifice of entering into the material world, that assigner chooses death, fall, sin, sorrow as the spirit's goads The gold is what pushes you forward to make progress. That dubious Godhead with his torch of pain lit up the chasm of the unfinished world and called her to fill with her vast self the abyss. He shows her the world is not the way it is supposed to be, and you have to fill up that gap between the way it is and the way it's supposed to be. So this being, Amalkiran wrote to Sri Aurobindo, who is this? Is it love? Is it time? Is it death? Is it pain? Sri Aurobindo says, well, it's not really any of these things, and I've deliberately not given it a name, but you can call him the Lord of Evolution, if you like. It's that which drives us forward on our path, faces us with the challenge that we need to fulfill our mission. And in Savitri's case, he has given her a particularly dreadful trial because she has a particularly great mission to fulfill. And so she needs that test, the ordeal of the foreknowledge of death and the heart's grief and pain that is needed for her to do her yoga and prepare herself to face this figure of death and destruction and denial. So in the end, the two will embrace and strive and each know each. So Aswapati, in the last lines of the section, we come back to Aswapati. Even in these formless coilings of the most primitive level of life emerging in matter, Aswapati could feel matter's response to an infant stir of soul. We're at page 141, just before the break. I'm on page 141. Oh yeah, line 300. Even in these formless coilings of primitive life, Aswapati could feel matter's response to an infant stir of soul, this movement in matter responding to the emergence of life. He watched the weak birth. These primitive things are so helpless, but they represent the weak birth of a tremendous force, of the supreme conscious force. He can pursue, can follow the riddle, this mystery of Godhead's tentative pace. God testing, is it this way, is it that way, is it the other way, as the emergence happens. Above all, he can hear faintly the rhythms of a great unborn muse, the rhythms of a great powerful goddess who is inspiring this wonderful creation, this symphony, this poem.
So, a question again regarding this topic of bliss.
Yes. Maybe what he suggests in book 6, canto 2, we should learn to recognize that pleasure, pain, indifference are just disguises of bliss. I don't know whether I can put my finger on those wonderful lines. Let's see. Book 6, canto 2, at the bottom of page 453. He's speaking to us at line 587. O mortal, have you got it? Page 453, line 587. O mortal, bear but ask not for the stroke. Too soon will grief and anguish find thee out. Too enormous is that venture for thy will. Only in limits can man's strength be safe. Yet is infinity thy spirit's goal. Its bliss is there behind the world's face of tears. Power is in thee that thou knowest not. Thou art a vessel of the imprisoned spark. It seeks relief from time's envelopment. The imprisoned spark, the soul, no? It wants to escape from the limitations imposed by time. And while thou shutst it in, the seal is pain. Bliss is the Godhead's crown, eternal, free, unburdened by life's blind mystery of pain. Pain is the signature of the ignorance, attesting the secret God denied by life. Until life finds him, pain can never end. Calm is self's victory, overcoming fate. Bear, thou shalt find at last thy road to bliss. Bliss is the secret stuff of all that lives. Even pain and grief are garbs of world delight. It hides behind thy sorrow and thy cry. Because thy strength is a part and not God's whole. Because, afflicted by the little self, thy consciousness forgets to be divine as it walks in the vague penumbra of the flesh and cannot bear the world's tremendous touch. Thou criest out and sayest that there is pain, indifference. Pain and joy, a triple disguise, attire of the rapturous dancer in the ways, withhold from thee the body of God's bliss. Thy spirit's strength shall make thee one with God. Thy agony shall change to ecstasy, indifference deepen into infinity's calm, and joy laugh nude on the peaks of the absolute. Bear, thou shalt find at last thy road to bliss. Not indifference, no? He says endurance, equality, developing equality, seeing the bliss in everything. So we'll stop there for today. Thanks to Shobindo.